Throughout this, I keep trying to call to our attention the providence of God. Overwhelming. Not that there's some statement that comes out, this is the providence of God, but it just stares around every corner. God is providing. There are a number of statements that indicate that God is engaged and involved, and he brings that about. Joseph realizes that in chapter 50. You meant it for evil, talking about his brothers, but God meant it for good. And so I just want to keep that before us in this study. Where we were at Wednesday night, we talked about the dreams of the cupbearer and the baker. Joseph was able to interpret those. 2 years later, the cupbearer had forgotten Joseph in prison, but Pharaoh had a dream, and so he mentions Joseph to the Pharaoh. And the Pharaoh had a couple of dreams. One was about fat cows and skinny cows come up out of the Nile and eat them. They don't look any different. The second was like unto it. And here's this grain with lots of stalks, lots of heads on it. And a skinny one came up and ate it. Again, this is visionary. This is a dream. And as we mentioned Wednesday night, when it comes to dreams, the physics doesn't play a reality in that. You know, whatever the mind does in normal dreaming. But here, God is giving these particular dreams. We don't have time to redevelop that. But we find that after Joseph comes out of prison, the cupbearer remembers him after 2 years, he interprets Pharaoh's dreams. And at the end of chapter 41, what we find is that as Joseph interprets those dreams, he tells us that there's going to be 7 years of plenty and there are going to be 7 years of famine. And so Pharaoh is appreciative of that and says, and Joseph recommended you put someone wise to keep an eye on things, to oversee this. And Pharaoh says, well, who could be wiser than one who God gives interpretation of dreams? And so Joseph is promoted. And, pardon me, verse 33 through 36 of chapter 41 is, here's the wisdom that's given. And Pharaoh liked it in verse 37, so he appoints Joseph. And it says in verse 40, only on the throne I will be greater than you. So Joseph will be the second authority in the land. It is interesting, later on, as you keep reading the chapters, there's something that comes up, and Pharaoh tells Joseph, you do this. And so it's just an interesting little subtle thing in there, and of course, Joseph does it. But it's to Joseph's benefit, and so it's just interesting. But you will be only second to me. Pharaoh gives him the signet ring and a golden necklace and his clothing and a second chariot and a proclamation, bow the knee. Now, bear in mind, when Joseph had some dreams, there's going to be some bowing involved, isn't there? And we'll come to that again in just a minute. But it's not just that dream. He is the second, pardon my expression, he's the vice president. No, no, he's way more powerful than that. He is the assistant Pharaoh. And we don't really take to heart that kind of authority and power. Basically, what Joseph said would go. What Pharaoh said would go. We saw that with the cupbearer and the baker. You're restored to office, you're going to die. That's the kind of authority that we're talking about here. And so what happens then, down in verse 45, Pharaoh named Joseph Zaphnath-Pinneah, and my footnote says probably Egyptian, for God speaks and he lives. So God has provided this dream, and very notably here, Joseph always gives God the glory and the credit. This power isn't within me, whether it was the fellows in prison or the Pharaoh. God is able to do this. I'm simply an instrument here. And so it tells us, verse 46, about Joseph's age. And so what they do then is they're going to store up grain in these years of plenty. Now, this is the chart that I had Wednesday night that we didn't get all the way through. But just at the very end of this, it tells us about Joseph's age, that he is 30 years old when he stands before Pharaoh. You can look at some other verses and see about he was 17 when he was sold. He's 30 years here in 45 and in verse 6. I'll just go ahead and mention this. In 45 and verse 6, it says, the famine has been in the land for these 2 years, and there are still 5 years in which there will be neither plowing nor harvesting. So by the time that happens, you're talking about Joseph was 30 years old, probably if you allow some months to get everything lined out before the plenty comes about. You're talking about 7 years. So how old would that have made Joseph? If you've got him at 30 years old, you got him at 37. 2 years of famine are underway. And so you've got him at 39 years old, approximately speaking here with these numbers. whenever these events happen, the brothers coming down, and Jacob's going to be heading that way. So just since we're at that number point here, I put those on there to help me. I hope it helps you a little bit. Chasing the numbers down here are a little tricky, and I have a sheet that I looked up last night late that does a little calculation on that is not necessary for our purpose this morning, but is interesting. By the way, when Jacob left to go to Laban's, how old do you picture him being? I wasn't here, I think, for that class. Sometimes when you see pictures, you know, he's just a kid. But he's a much, much older guy, like 71 or something like that, when he goes to Laban's. And so when the math is done, it's just an interesting adjunct. But looking at all these numbers, again, is interesting. In verses 46 through 49, how good were these years of plenty? How good were they? They were extremely good. I mean, you talk about bumper crops. It reminds me of the promises that God made to Israel. If the Jewish people will be faithful to me, a few of you will chase multitudes of your enemy. You'll have bumper crops. You know, harvest gets done, it'll be time to harvest again. There's just so much plenty. God provides here. This Nile Valley, this Nile River area was a very productive land anyway. But here are some great years. And if you've ever been around farming, you know that years really vary. Sometimes it's feast, sometimes it's famine. That's how farmers think about it, and you have to figure out. These are great years. And so they're storing up a fifth of the produce. It was the recommendation of verse 34. And so it says in verse 49, thus Joseph stored up grain in great abundance like the sand of the sea until he stopped measuring it, for it was beyond measure. So they had grain stored up. They were ready to go. Hadn't thought about it too much before, but this land of Egypt, would that be a good place to store grain? Yeah, it's dry. Okay, you got some good conditions there. And so that helps with storage. You want to keep grain dry. You dry it in the first place. If it's not dry, they would sun dry or whatever if it needed to be, but a lot of times it probably doesn't need a lot. And so they had means to store it, and they do. And so in verse 53 through 57, to get us wrapped up in chapter 41, and then we'll go forward, how do things go after the 7 years of plenty come to an end in verse 53, the following verses? How does it go for the Egyptians?
We have famine.
Okay, there's a famine in the land, but how does it go for them? You are right. They're okay. All this grain's been stored up. By the way, how do you think the people feel about Pharaoh and Joseph at this moment? Okay. But what happens in verse 56 and 7? How far did the famine spread? Yeah, all over that area, all over the earth, it says here. All over that area. And so what is going to happen of necessity? People are going to go where there's food. Now, this may sound like a crazy question, but giraffes and lions hang out together? Or wildebeest and lions, do they hang out together? Not normally. But guess what happens in Africa? The dry season, the water dries up, and you've got water holes. Guess what comes to the water hole? Everything. You've got to have water. And so you'll see pictures of lions coming up to get water. They're concerned they need that. Other animals are keeping their distance. They're watching, but they've got to have water. Well, when you got this famine, guess what happens? People come to where the food's at. Now, you remember my chart that I keep emphasizing? Think of the providence of God. God is bringing his people to this land to preserve them and to build a great nation. And by the time we get to the book of Exodus, some things will have changed, but that's what has transpired. They have grown to an immense separate entity, a nation, and they're going through rough times, but God is providing for them. So questions or comments down through here. I know there's much, much more that we could say, but I will not get through chapter 43 if I don't go forward. Anything you'd like to observe there or notice? I was talking to Rachel beforehand just to mention this, that she brought up a really good question about the guard that Joseph was sold to Potiphar. My translation said who was the head of the bodyguards, and the ESV translates it differently. Could there be a connection there with the jailer and all? And I tried to go back and do some research, and I could not come up with a definitive answer. So Rachel and I got to talk about that a little bit while ago. It's an interesting thing. I tend not to think so, but the truth of the matter is I don't know for sure. And so I'll just lay the cards on the table. You see the hand, and that's so I've got. If you want to talk about that more afterwards, I'd be happy to. Not that I know all that much about it, but I did try to chase that down some. All right, now in chapter 42, what happens? Verses 1 through 5, and what insights do we gain, and who doesn't go to Egypt? So there are several questions in the first five verses of chapter 42. First of all, what happens? They need food. Jacob saw there was grain in Egypt, and he said to his sons, "Why are you staring at one another?" I think it's an interesting statement. "What are you doing standing around staring at each other? Go get some food." You ever felt that way? Never felt that way at work? What are you all doing standing around here looking at each other? We got stuff to get done. Well, anyway, they're getting hungry, and so he says, "Why are you standing here?" And so he's going to send them. What else do you see? All of them go but Benjamin. And why does he not go in verse 4?
He doesn't want to lose another son.
Yeah, he says, "I'm afraid harm will come to him." How does it make you feel if you're one of the other brothers, probably? "Yeah, you guys go get killed off, I don't care. But Benjamin, he's going to stay here." No, I'm overstating the case a little bit. But that, undoubtedly, that's always been felt. I mean, we've seen that at the beginning. And it is a stark contrast here. anything else you see in here? Interesting. Why does he send them at the end of verse 2? "Buy some from this place so we may live and not die." So again, they realize, you know, how this plays out. Okay. Morning. We're in chapter 42. We just tried to wrap up chapter 41 in a very brief way. And so what insights do we get from these verses? I mean, just practical for us. Okay. When there's a need, you rise and do what you need to do. You don't stand around, look at the wall. You get up and go. You do what you need to do. Rachel?
I mean, they were faithful, so they believed that God would provide, but that didn't mean that they just sat there and waited for God to
very,
down.
Very good.
Heaven,
yeah, and that's a powerful, powerful lesson. And God did provide, didn't he?
Yes.
Yeah. But they had to get busy and do what's theirs to do. And, you know, that's a great lesson for us. God will provide, but he doesn't say stand around and look at the wall. He said get busy and do what I told you to do. Make the sacrifices. Get in there and do what you need to do. I'll take care of my end. So that is a great application. Shannon.
Which is, I think, one of the main lessons that you look at Joseph, and that's what he did, right? You know, wallow in self, pity for the circumstance that he was in. He did what he could, and God made sure that he was successful.
Okay, very good. Okay. I don't want to stall here, but is Joseph the kind of guy you'd like to have for a friend? I don't mean because he's a second ruler of Egypt. Yeah, he's a man of character. He's a man that goes forward and does what he needs to do. There seems to be a good level of humility in view of the fact that he's a big, fine physical specimen, handsome. I think, he has good ability. God provided all the way through. Again, I can make the argument like Gideon, I'm going to give you the increase. There's no way you can do this on your own, Gideon, so I'm going to give you 300 men instead of 32,000 to win this war. You need to understand. And so I can make that argument about Joseph. But to me, every indication, he's a capable man. But what happens here does not play out because simply of his own capacities. All through here it says God provides. God does this for him. He knows it. He gives God the glory in this. Yeah, I think we'd love to have him as a friend. Yeah. And when he's the second guy in Egypt, you get to eat. So, all right. Anything else in here?
Well, I mean, the thing is that he only attained this position because of the way God had blessed Joseph and that he could interpret those genes.
That's right.
After that, he would not be here.
That's right. That's
and
right.
That, and that's, it's the journey. It's not just kind of where you end up.
Yeah.
Look back, and he knows that. He knows God's
provided. Are there some times in life where there's a critical point? There's an opportunity that comes your way. Now, I would have been happy had Jared Ford made a different decision than moving to Texas. But he had an opportunity to come before him. It's like his, this is once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. Sometimes there are unique things, and there are points that will impact your life. And so back to Joseph, you know, he's doing what's right. He's going along the way. I don't know that he can see his way all through this, and we've talked about those things, but he trusts God. What about partiality here? So I don't get slowed down too much. Does that play out well in human minds?
Well, Benjamin's still alive.
What's that?
Benjamin's still alive.
Okay, Benjamin's still alive. Okay. How does it play out with the family? Is it a tough thing? It's going to be hard. Okay, it does come turn out well in the end, and things come together by God's provision. Okay, well, what about verses 6-17? How do things unfold with Joseph and brothers when the Jacob's sons minus Benjamin go to Egypt? Joseph, it says in verse 6, was the ruler, and he was the one who sold to all the people of the land. And what happens at the end of verse 6? Joseph's brothers bow down. Okay, does it make you think of anything? Yeah, I've got on the overhead here. If you drop on down to verse 9, what does it say? Joseph remembered the dreams which he had about them, and he said to them, "You're spies." And so he deals with them roughly. Do they know who Joseph is? No. Does Joseph know who they are? He recognizes them. Okay. And so they don't know. Now, would Joseph's brothers expect Joseph to understand their Hebrew language? Now, he'd be using an interpreter in there. But as things unfold, you know, Joseph knows what they're saying. Okay. Is there something maybe to learn from that also? Be mindful of what you say, where you say, when you say. And sometimes you can do a lot. And overseas, you know, you learn some words, you learn a few things, and you can get adrift what's going on sometimes in that. And people think you don't know, and most of the time I don't know without help. But they speak a lot of English where I go these days. But anyway, it's a powerful lesson to learn. And so, anyhow, they're talking. Why do you think Joseph addresses them in this way? You're spies. Okay, maybe revenge. Okay.
To me, it seems like a really sudden, good plan to get everyone together and for him to test them at the same time to see their integrity. They actually did let it know that they had one brother that was back. And so he quickly devised this plan. This is how I'm going to see Benjamin. And also I'm going to see how these men have turned out over the years.
Okay. What's their claim down in verse 11? We're not spies. Verse 11 says, we're honest men. Okay. That has not encapsulated all that they have done in this biblical narrative. But they are not their spies. I mean, not that this has anything to do with it, but if you're going to be a spy, can you be an honest guy? Not and live very long. And so he said, no, we're not spies. We're just ordinary men. We're honest men. We're not spies. And so he says there's one, the youngest, who's back home with our father. And what else does he say at the end of verse 13?
One who's not
alive. Yeah, one who's not alive and one is no more. So they don't realize this is Joseph. You know, Joseph's been sold. They don't let the cat out of the bag here. At this moment, they didn't say, well, you know, we sold him to some Ishmaelites and don't know what happened to him. You say he is just no more. Anything else down through verse 17 that you see interesting?
You know, I think going back one chapter, not to slow down too much, but, you know, thinking about, you know, when he named his son Manasseh, mm-hmm. right? God has made me forget all my hardship and all my, you know, and all my father's house. He's, right, God has brought him to a better point than where he was previously. He's forgot, you know, he's made him forget about the pain that he's had, but he's not forgotten about the character of his brothers.
Okay.
You know, like I mean, it seems reasonable to think. Can I trust these people? No, I cannot trust these people.
Yeah. Okay. There's an interesting thing I hadn't thought about before, but with that name Manasseh is helpful. Joseph is in a great place. If you're in a great place, can God make it even better? He can, and he does.
He will.
One way or the other. Yeah, but that's just an interesting thing here. As good as everything is, because of Joseph's faithfulness and his provision and God's plan, you know, things are going to even get better. His family's going to be there, and they're going to be taken care of. He's going to get to spend these years with them, which probably never expected a little earlier on to happen. Okay? At verse 17, and so what does he do to them? His brothers. Joseph to the brothers. He puts him in prison for 3 days. Okay? And what does he propose in verse 16? I've got it on the chart here, verse 16. I'm going to send one of you back home to get the brother, and he puts him in jail. And so then, in verses 18 through 20, what does Joseph propose? What is a particular requirement? Sorry, I got the L-Y on there. Requirement by Joseph. I didn't have power last night till about 9:30 or 10 o'clock. That storm took us out, and so I was worried about getting the Zoom link out, but I was able to do that with a hotspot in my phone. And anyway, so normally I would put L-Y on there, but this morning I just put L-Y on there, and L-Y wasn't supposed to be there, so it's on there. So what does Joseph propose in verses 18 through 20, but what's the one particular requirement that he puts in there? Okay, bring the youngest brother. I'm going to send all of you back except there's going to be one that's going to stay. Okay? And so we see that. Okay, in verse 21 through 24, the brothers speak. Say, oh man, we are in a mess here. And so they start talking with each other in verse 21 through 24. And what things do we learn from here? I mean, these are very interesting verses.
To me, verse 21 is the biggest tragedy of this whole thing.
Okay.
This is the part that gets a lump in my throat and seems to be heavy in my chest.
Yeah.
10 men have gone 20 years and borne this guilt every day because at the instance of this adversity in their lives, suddenly now to the forefront, they have this comes up right away, which tells me that they've been bearing this.
That's right.
For how long? And what a tragedy it is to have something like that shape their lives and shape who they are. This is grievous to think about the guilt they've done for all these years.
That is exactly right. And We Are Honest Men didn't play out real well over those years, did it?
No.
Joseph
didn't read chapter 38.
Yeah. And so as you look at this, their relationship with their father is brokenhearted, and they're having to live with this. And the other thing here in verse 21, they remember when they sold Joseph, they saw the distress of his soul when he pleaded with us, don't do this. They sold him and sent him away. That's added. The earlier chapter didn't explain that. And that puts the humanity in this and the hatred at the time and their act. You think they regretted it after it happened? Probably. And here probably is reflect, but that's. Now, what does Reuben say in verse 22? What's that?
I told you so.
I tried to get you not do this. And so Reuben says, did I not tell you, do not sin against the boy? And you would not listen. Now comes the reckoning for his blood that goes with what Tommy was just saying. They've had to live with this, and they feel the guilt. And that God is a God of justice. And so they're feeling that. There's going to be something else here. Shannon?
Well, they live with the guilt. Part of that is because they live with a secret.
That's right.
Right? I mean, they have not come clean to their father after all of these
That's
years.
Right.
And you know, it's like, well, I mean, it's like, how could you come clean after 20 years?
Yeah.
You've been lying to me for 20 years. The
cat's going to be out of the bag before it's done, though, isn't it? Yeah. Okay. Now, it is interesting. What else in verse 23 and 24 do you notice here? Some powerful things. What does Joseph learn at this moment? Okay. They learned about their feelings all these years. And what else? You remember Where was Reuben when they sold Joseph? He'd gone away. He wasn't privy to that. He came, what have you done? Where's he at? Joseph, I would assume. I don't figure they're all in it, but he, you see that inside here. Reuben's making his plea. Didn't I plead with you? But they don't think Joseph's hearing him, as we mentioned a while ago. It says, they did not know, however, that Joseph understood, for there was an interpreter between them. And so he is overwhelmed, and he turned away from them and wept. But when he returned to them and spoke to them, he took Simeon from them and bound him before their eyes. Why Simeon? He's not the oldest.
He's the oldest of the guilty.
Okay. Yeah, this is interesting. You know, Reuben has passed over here. Simeon is the oldest of the guilty. And so he's going to be kept here. The rest of the boys are going to be sent back home to get Benjamin. And so we find those interesting things. All right, in verse 25 through 28, what happens on their way home to see Jacob? They go back. They've got their bags of grain to take back with them at this moment. Okay, they find money there, and as this unfolds, they all find later their money's in there. How do you think they feel about that? Oh, man, we're already in hot water. The heat just got turned up. We are in trouble. And so we see that happen. What else?
Yeah, I mean, related to that, it's an interesting statement they make when they realize that. Since their heart sank, they turn trembling to one another. And what they say is, yep. What is this that God has done to us? It's almost like the guilt trip, you know? It's like, oh, now we feel even worse. Because
yeah, or justice, you know? But as mentioned, yeah, God, they know that ultimately God has control here. That they are feeling rotten. All this is accumulated. And frankly, just to bring the points that have been made to a head here, what we have to do when things aren't right, we just need to straighten it out. We didn't make it right. Don't let it be like a cancer inside it eat us. And so these things are weighing. And ultimately, even if it doesn't come out in this world, it will in the day of judgment, God knows. But I don't have to live with that guilt. And that's one of the wonderful things about God, who is merciful. And we could look at some extreme cases like Manasseh in the Old Testament to demonstrate that as well. So when they come to their father in verses 29 through 38, how did things unfold when they get home? Starting in verse 29, when they came to their father Jacob. Let me start there. They're explaining to their father. So how does that go? Okay, the man who sold us the grain thinks we're spies. Simeon is there. And what else did Joseph tell them in verse 34 that they tell their father?
Take Benjamin back with
them. Yeah, bring your youngest brother. Bring Benjamin back. Okay, and then he also says in verse 35, now it came about as they were emptying their sacks that behold, every man's bundle of money was in his sack. And when they and their father saw the bundles of money, they were dismayed. And so, you know, one found it, but now all of them have that. And so what does Reuben propose in verse 37 and 38?
Kill my own sons. I can't bring Benjamin back.
Okay. Let me take Benjamin. Why would he want to go back so bad? Who's in Egypt? Okay, Simeon. His brother's there. What else is evident? This famine is severe. Why'd they go in the first place? Look, this needs to be done. And so those things are involved here. And as was mentioned in verse 37, you may put my two sons to death. If I do not bring him back to you, put him in my care, and I will return him to you. And Jacob said, my son shall not go down with you, for his brother is dead, and he alone is left. If harm should befall him on the journey you are taking, then you will bring my gray hair down to Sheol and Sarla. It'll kill me. So he doesn't listen to Reuben. Reuben makes this plea. Reuben does all, really, that he could at this moment to get his father to send Benjamin. Okay. Comments there before we continue on with chapter 43. Questions or anything?
I think it's interesting. If you find out
charge for
for something at a store, what do you do with that? And the honest thing to do would be go in and say, hey, I wasn't charged for this.
Okay.
And take the money back. They were afraid, and I think, you know, was Joseph giving them a gift, or was this another test? You know?
Yeah, it's a good question. Yeah. Okay. Matt.
A comment from earlier from 42. I think this is a good example of why we should watch out what we wish for, because you just might get it. The old cliche, careful what you wish for.
Okay.
I think even if you really, really, really want something, you need to examine your motivations for why you want it, because you might just get what you want. And if his brothers really wanted him out of the picture, and they got it, but 20 years later, it's still
okay.
When something happens, they ascribe that bad event to something that happened 20 years ago. That's how badly they felt about what they wish for it.
Okay. Do people do, allow my expression, stupid things when they're envious or jealous or angry?
I do stupid things when I'm not angry.
Yeah, me too. But that is the heart of what's going on, this jealousy, this envy, all these things, that hatred comes with anger, comes with it. And so they do some things that they have to pay dearly for year after year after year. Again, we can find forgiveness with God, and we need to be thankful for that. But we also need to understand that there are consequences in making decisions that are not the decisions God would have us to make, not to be godly decisions. Chapter 43, verses 1 through 15, since we only have about 7 or 8 minutes. In verses 1 through 15, what changes Jacob's mind from the response at the end of chapter 42? He won't let Benjamin go back with Reuben, but what changes his mind? They get hungry. Okay, look, the handwriting's on the wall. We've got to have food. And so Judah is going to make a plea here in verse 8. Judah said to his father, "Send the lad with me, and we will rise and go, that we may live and not die, we as well as you and our little ones. And I myself will be a surety for him. You may hold me responsible for him. If I do not bring him back to you, set him before you, then let me bear the blame before you forever." That's a pretty bold statement.
It seems to me like some time has transpired here, because they ate grain.
Yeah.
So there is some time that's gone by. And we're at verse 2, and this wouldn't be the first time that they sat down and ate a meal while a brother was in prison, because they did that with Joseph. They threw him in a pit, and then they sat down and ate.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
So it sounds like some time has gone by. They've got forces against them. They don't want to disappoint their father. They've got an edict from their father. And they also had Pharaoh saying, don't show your face here again until you bring Benjamin. They can't go back and even pay for the food that they're free. So this has been vexing.
Okay, verse 10, I think, supports that comment. "For if we had not delayed, surely by now we could have returned twice." So there's your time frame. Mentioned it here, even though the specifics aren't given. We should have been back long ago. Is that going to help our case? We don't show up? Probably not. And so, you know. So anyway, he agrees. But how does Jacob respond to that in verses 11 through 15? In verse 11, he says, "If it must be so, then do this." And so what does Jacob tell them to do here? Take this nice gift in verse 11, described out the best that we have, balm, a little honey, and so forth. What about the money in verse 12?
Double.
Yeah, take it back and double it, okay? And so, pardon me a second here.
It seems like he is wanting to take extra measure to pay him, in a sense, like tribute toward Joseph.
Okay.
He must take a little more insurance on getting Benjamin back.
Okay.
He's not going to lose his only other son from Rebekah.
Do gifts tend to set a good table at the beginning? Just in human? Yeah. The proverb writer talks about that. Okay. And so, you know, you don't want those things to be empty, but certainly that happens. And he says, perhaps it was a mistake that it was put in our bags. And down in verse 12, he says, Jacob says, "As for me," in verse 14, the end of that verse, "as for me, if I am bereaved of my children, I am bereaved." So the men took this present, they took the double money in their hand, and Benjamin, then they arose and went down to Egypt and stood before Joseph. So that's how this unfolds. Now, in verses 16 through 25, when they come to Jacob's house, what happens in these verses? Does Joseph see them in these verses for long?
He's going to have a meal.
Okay, they're going to have a meal, so he tells his steward, take them in the house there. Joseph goes on about his business. And so these brothers are having to explain to this steward, here's what happened, you know, the money got put in her bag and all that. He says in verse 21, each man's money was in the mouth of his sack. What does the steward or the servant of Joseph say here in verse 23? Be at ease. Don't be afraid. I mean, I think they probably needed those words at this moment. And so what does the servant know at this point? I don't know. But, you know, he may have probably knew, as we read it, it was intentional, it was done on purpose. And, again, you wonder how much is for the testing of his brothers. What are they going to do about this as well to see what's really in them? And so that conversation takes place. Now, in verse 26 through 30, it's going to tell us about Joseph and his response. So Joseph came home in verse 26. Verse 29, as he, Joseph, lifted his eyes and saw his brother Benjamin, his mother's son, he said, is this your youngest brother of whom you spoke to me? And he said, may God be gracious to you, my son. So he's inquiring. Does he not recognize Benjamin, or is he just playing the role? I'm not sure. There are only a few years difference in age probably with Joseph and Benjamin. You go back and, again, do the math from the time that he took Rachel as a wife, and as he was with Laban, and he leaves. Benjamin's born on the way from there, maybe 5 or 6 years, something. I don't know exactly. It's a guesstimate, but there's not a huge, it's not like 20 years age difference if you go back and sort that out. But yeah, this is Joseph, or I'm sorry, this is Benjamin. And so how does Joseph respond in verse 30? He is absolutely overwhelmed. So he dismisses himself, and he found a place to weep. He entered his chamber and wept there in verse 30. And then he washed his face in verse 31. He came out and he controlled himself and said, serve the meal. Okay. So they still don't know this is Joseph. Now, since our time is gone, verse 31 through 34, a couple things I want us to notice here. What was the relationship between the Egyptians and the Hebrew people in verse 32? Yeah, Egyptians considered the Hebrews unclean, and so they're going to keep their distance. And so you see this separation. They ate by themselves because the Egyptians could not eat bread with the Hebrews, for that is loathsome to the Egyptians. Now, consider the impact of that. I put up here in yellow. God is trying to preserve a nation. As Israel is going to come and live in the land of Goshen, that there's going to be sort of a wall that's built there that will help protect this people. He brings them out of Canaan. He makes them their own entity there. But this verse helps give us a little bit of insight to attitudes that prevail. And then what happens in verse 33 and 34 as lunch is to be served? Okay, Benjamin's going to get the biggest portion. And what else happens here to the surprise of the brothers? What?
He sets
them in order. Yeah, Joseph sets them in order from the oldest to the youngest. And they're going, what? Come back Wednesday evening for the exciting continuation of the saga of Joseph. Thank you so much. We're out of time. God bless.